Welcome back to more of Talking Trivia with your host, Morgan White Jr. on Touch 1060 AM. Morgan will be with you in a moment, but first...
Yes, maybe that brings back a memory or two for anybody out there. Good old Walt Disney music, bibbidi-bobbidi-boo, and pumpkins turned into horses and other magical things happened. Well, speaking of magical things happening, we have the man who made that musical magic on the line now, Jerry Livingston, who has written probably more themes than anybody else I can think of, both for movies and television. And without further ado, good afternoon, Mr. Livingston. How are you?
How are you, Morgan?
Oh, doing fine, doing fine. What's the weather like out in
California? I'm looking at sunshine. I'm in my office facing my backyard, and it's a beautiful day after 25 inches of rain this past season. But our home isn't sliding into the ocean because we're on the flats on Rodeo Drive, and I'm looking at flowers of all colors, orange trees, fruit trees. What can I tell you?
Sounds like we all should come over to your house for a nice, comfortable afternoon.
Come to my house. We'll have tea.
Fine. Next time I get out to California, I will.
I just heard bibbidi-bobbidi-boo, and you brought back some tremendous memories.
Well, we have many of the themes that you have written handy to play off and on during the interview.
Yeah.
And believe me, I was impressed to see the different types of music that you have written.
Thank you.
I had told my producer when we knew we were coming back to the station about 2 months ago, that there was one person that I wanted. And he said, who? I said, Jerry Livingston. He said,
uh-huh.
That name sounds familiar. And I said, you see his name in credits all over the place. For an example, the Bugs Bunny Roadrunner theme, This Is It.
The Bugs Bunny TV theme?
Yes.
And well, that's on every Saturday morning on, I think, maybe your network.
Yes, it's CBS out here also.
And another network, I have Casper the Friendly Ghost the same time.
Well, I explained to him that not only had you written that theme, but I had been watching an old movie from Warner Brothers called Sergeant Rutledge. And
Sergeant
you did the theme to that Captain Buffalo.
Yes, I've written about 35 or 40 films out here, Morgan, and among them are what you just said. And I also wrote the end birthday song for Alice in Wonderland. That's that 15-minute scene in the woods.
Yes.
The Mad Tea Party. And I wrote The Hanging Tree, got an Academy Award nomination, and I wrote Cat Ballou, The Ballad of Cat Ballou.
Well, I know we have Cat Ballou handy, and we have
so
Cat.
And so many other pictures. I wrote about 7 Martin and Lewis pictures, and so many others. I've done about 35 or 40 films, and most of them with main collaborator, Mac David. And we've written hundreds of songs together, pop songs, Tin Pan Alley, New York and California and out here. And we've done about 15 television themes. We also did 77 Sunset Strip.
Yeah, we have that to play later on,
and
too.
Hawaii and I and Lawman and Bronco and all the rest of the jazz.
How do you begin with a theme?
Well, I can't hear you, Morgan.
Okay, how do you begin with a theme if a producer or a director comes to you and states, I am going to be doing this type of show, it's a Western. For an example, let's talk about Bronco, since you mentioned Bronco.
Bronco.
How did that begin? As far as the let's say William T. Orr, I don't know if he was the one, but being the head honcho at Warner Brothers then.
Well, it's very simple. They all start either one of two ways. Either they give us a script, or else they'll have, like in '77, they had a picture they were about to release, and they showed the picture to your ABC people of that period, the network, and they said it'd make a very good television series, and it evolved into 77 Sunset Strip, and so we saw the film with the different characters in it, and then So we went to work and wrote the theme of 77 Sunset. So they come in various ways, either through a script of a screenplay or a TV series or a pilot or that type of thing.
All right. Since you mentioned 77 Sunset Strip and they already had the pilot done, they showed you the pilot and then
yes.
you came up with the theme.
Yes.
And what...
Well, with Bronco, all they had was a couple of manuscripts.
Right.
And so we wrote the theme based on that.
All right. But just since I know
films too.
We have 77 Sunset Strip handy, and one thing I wanted to find out before I play it, you
I write the music, Morgan.
Yeah. Well, you and Mr. David wrote it. But what special thing out of 77 Sunset Strip gave you the beat that you used, or was there anything special that gave you the beat or the lyrics? What was the inspiration for the particular way 77 Sunset Strip ran?
Well, the way it looked to me with a private eye feel, I felt it had to have sort of a blues feeling. And I think what made that whole thing, as far as the theme song, was that... 77 Sunset Strip, the two snaps?
Yes.
That came because there was an empty space in the music and we didn't know what to put in there, so I snapped my fingers while working and somebody said, "That's it. That'll do. Don't put any music in there. No figures."
You know, that was probably the most identifiable piece of music during the early 60s, and the snap is what sold it. Well, tell you what, I'm gonna play that
right
now.
By the way, and unusual for TV themes, it became a very big popular song hit.
It did.
Yes,
well,
very big worldwide.
Well, tell you what.
Right now in the world, someplace are playing these TV series.
Well, I'm going to play it right now, both for you to hear and for everybody else. And here's 77 Sunset Strip.
All right.
77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. It wears a fancy label. The store is by the song and table. The most exciting people pass you by. Including a private eye. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. The highbrow and the hipster, the starlet and the pony tipster, you find most every kind of gal and guy, including a private eye. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip. 77 Sunset Strip.
With Jerry Livingston.
Hello.
Touch 1060.
Morgan?
Yes, Jerry.
I got a kick out of that This Is It you just played. Mel Blanc and I are very dear friends. And he was in Boston recently, he told me.
Yes.
I think he was with you. But anyway, I have family in Boston. May I say hello?
Definitely.
My son, they live in Brookline, Mass. And my son, Dennis, is in high tech, and my daughter-in-law is a very well-known, highly talented artist in Boston and New England, Karen Moss, and my granddaughter, Melissa, and I want to say hello, because I'm crazy about this family of mine there. We'll be back east in June.
Well, when you
ask me some more.
Well, when you come back, I'd definitely like to have a chance to meet you, but since you mentioned This Is It, I wanted to add in something. I was trying to get a hold of the copy. But I have done some work here with a local TV station that had been showing Warner Brothers cartoons at night.
Yeah.
And they would use filler in between the cartoons by interviewing people on the street. asking them what their favorite cartoons were and to do imitations. And there were a group of girls when we were filming this last summer that walked by, and I gave them the lyrics to This Is It. I wrote them down for them so they could sing it. And they all sang it at the and they did a great job, and they're really hamming it up. And I wasn't able to get the copy in time to play it today, but I will definitely include it into the copy of the tape of this interview that we're sending to you. I thought you might enjoy that. But let's talk about This Is It as far as scoring cartoons. Now, most people don't realize it's probably a lot tougher to score on cartoons than it is for live action. Is that true?
That was easy for us to do because we did do, for Walt Disney, this great man who really knew what he was doing, we wrote the whole score, Mac and I and Al Hoffman. That's how the first time we came out here in 49. And we learned so much from writing the Cinderella score of, Bibbidi Bobbidi and A Dream Is a Wish and the work song and the whole thing. And by the way, that was the the only score in many, many years where three songs from the one picture were on the hit parade at the same time.
I didn't know
that. The work song and A Dream Is a Wish Your Heart Makes and Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo, and that was very thrilling. By the way, and we'll get back to what you said, but I'm talking to you from my study and my office where my files are and everything. And I'm looking around the room, and I'm looking at a wall full of, I don't want to sound hammy, a wall full of awards and plaques and Academy nominations. And while talking, I'm wandering around here with my eyes. And also, my biggest thrill the last few years was I was elected to the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 1980, Morgan. That was very gratifying.
Now, how many, is that a new, I've never heard of the Songwriters Hall of Fame. I've heard of other Hall of Fames.
Well, this is the one because you're elected by your peers such as, Cy Coleman and Sammy Kahn and all the great writers that are alive. And posthumously, members of the Songwriters Hall of Fame are Rodgers and Hammerstein and such.
Yeah. And
so what can I tell you?
You made it in 1980?
To be elected by your peers.
Congratulations to you for finally getting that award. Just out of curiosity, I don't know how long it takes to put together a particular piece of music, but what was the longest time it took you to write one piece of music and the shortest time it took you to put together a piece of music?
All right. And by the way, we didn't include This Is It stemmed from, it was easy to do because they had some little cartoon drawings, and it was very easy because we had learned all of those things from doing the Disney shows, pictures.
Because
so that was easy.
The timing on this is great.
And also the timing. It had to be like 45 seconds or 50 seconds, so we had to work it in. So it became a 16-bar song for the Bugs Bunny TV theme. And what'd you ask me?
Well,
the longest or the shortest?
The longest time it took you to complete one particular theme or score, and the shortest time it took you to do a score, and what score was it?
The longest, I believe, was, The Twelfth of Never. I wrote with Paul Francis Webster, the great lyric writer. We've written 100 songs together out here. And we started, and we were both very busy, and we got together at various times. I'd say that took about a week. But we had the whole thing rolling, but we couldn't conclude it,
Right.
And it became a great standard, thanks to Johnny Mathis and everybody else.
Yeah, I think he's probably the most famous person to have recorded The Twelfth of Never.
Yes, and since then, I have about 150 albums here of the song. It's one of my biggest standards now, that and Mairzydotes.
Mairzydotes and Dozydotes.
The shortest song to write was Mairzydotes. That took about a half an hour. And by the way, people thought, still think, that we wrote that because of World War II. We wrote Mairzydotes 2 years before World War II, and we couldn't give it away. Nobody wanted it. They thought it was little, song and dance, tra-la-la, get lost, baby,
Yeah.
But it turned out to be Mairzydotes.
And that took only a half hour to complete.
That took about a half hour, yeah.
So I guess on an average, if you say the longest was a week and the shortest was a half hour, probably after you know exactly what you are to do for a producer or director, a day or two is about right to come up with a theme?
Yes, and sometimes in a couple of hours. I remember when I was in New York in my first year or two, and I wrote, It's the Talk of the Town, and under a blanket of blue.
Yeah.
They didn't take very long. Maybe because I was on fire, you know. But Talk of the Town took, I think, one afternoon.
All right. Well, I'll tell you what. I know that my producer has some more themes.
What'd you say?
My producer has some more themes handy.
Right.
Of some works that you have done that I know a lot of people will recognize. And I want to try to get most of them in during the interview, because I just want to show people the variety of works that you've done. So
right.
Without further ado, we'll go into the next one. Here it is.
All right.
A Lion Eye. A Lion Eye. Starring Troy Donahue, Robert Conrad, Connie Stevens, Humphrey Park, and Grant Williams as Greg McKenzie. Troy Donahue,
Sir Side 6,
Diane Williams,
Sir Side 6,
Lee Patterson,
in Miami Beach.
Starring Diane McBain and Margarita Sierra.
And we are back on Touch 1060 with Jerry Livingston. Jerry, when is the last time that you heard some of these?
Oh, thank you. You're bringing back great memories.
How long has it been since you've heard some of these?
Well, when I play my albums.
You probably have...
But I've been told that, like, a couple of years ago, Lawman was a very big hit again in the Far East, in Japan. And I understand that right now, 77 Sunset Strip is a big hit in Italy. So there they go. They never quit someplace on this planet.
No, they're probably going to live forever, and I'm sure... Whenever I am requested to play themes, I can tell by the sound of the person's voice that they have a great love for hearing this, because it brings back not only the memories of seeing the show, but it brings back memories of when they were younger and the whole lifestyle that they had when these shows and movies were popular.
Yeah. And I received several Academy Award nominations, The Hanging Tree and The Ballad of Cat Ballou from Cat Ballou and Bibbidi Bobbidi Boo from Cinderella, and I've received several Golden Globes and so forth and other awards. Around my wall, I'm glancing at them. I think I told you.
Yeah.
And it's been a joy. I also write country and western, you know.
Well,
nobody knows it. I've had a couple of the number one songs of the world. Adios Amigo, Jim Reeves.
Yes.
That was mine.
Any others?
I like to write everything. You mentioned, we know that it's Palm Sunday, and I've been writing through the years religioso type albums, you know, with story and music.
Yeah.
And fitting today, I wrote A World of Miracles that was narrated by Walter Brennan with the orchestra and choir and a man named Moses, George Beverly Shea, and I love writing, well, as you can tell, I love writing the whole gamut. I've written everything except opera or light opera. That's not my field.
All right, well, how did you begin? I imagine that you studied music in school, but
yeah.
How did you go from the studying of music to applying it to the work that you're doing now? What was your, I guess, first big break?
That's very simple. Well, I was born in Denver, Colorado, and I took the usual piano lessons, and then I played in some Denver orchestras, and music was in my house. My dad used to play on the piano. He couldn't read, but he faked. And so I was surrounded by music when I was growing up. And then when I was about 18, I left and I went to the University of Arizona in Tucson, and I wrote the school show there, and then I got the desire to go back to New York. I said, where is Tin Pan Alley? And I headed east with an orchestra, and I landed in New York with $9, you know, the usual bit.
Yeah.
And then while in school, I wrote the first college musical for a freshman for the senior fathers. But in New York, I started playing club dates. But my whole dream was to, I was playing in various restaurants so I could eat, Chinese restaurants. But as my dad said, my ace in the hole was my union card. And so, but my big dream was to write songs. And so while working, I was writing a song a day. Nothing was happening. I was writing with Al Symes and with Marty Symes and Al Nyberg. And then we got lucky and we wrote, my first hit was When It's Darkness on the Delta, thanks to Mildred Bailey. She heard it and loved it. And from then on, we were like a roaring tigers on Broadway. Then came Awake, then happened from a break here and there. We had the number one song of the country, of the United States, that Perry Como made a record of called Chababa Chababa. And just at that time, Walt Disney was in town, and he said, who wrote that silly song, crazy song? And he was thinking of somebody to write Cinderella. And we auditioned for Walt Disney because he loved Chababa. And 3 months later, we were out here in California writing Cinderella. Then we went back to New York, we completed it. And then a year or two later, Mac David and I came out here. We knew Martin and Lewis when they just became a team and got very big, you know?
Yes.
And so we came back out here with Martin and Lewis, and we wrote about 6 or 7 pictures for them. They're still on the air at night, on your stations too, I'm sure.
Yes,
they are. With the Army.
Definitely.
Sailor Beware, Jumping Jacks, The Stooge, Scared Stiff, and what can I tell you? I've also written for Presley, Elvis Presley picture, Follow That Dream. And so I like to cover the whole field, Morgan. It's more fun that way.
All right, well, one thing that you mentioned when you write for...
I didn't mean to tell you the whole thing, but...
No, that's what I wanted. I definitely wanted that. And when you mentioned that you write for a movie, most people don't realize you don't only write the songs, the lyrics for completing a 2 or 3 minute song in a movie, but you also do the incidental music, the background music.
I don't do the scoring of the background music, Morgan. Somebody out here, you know, a background score does that. I write the music for the songs, and I must tell you that most of the pictures that Mac David and I have written for have not just been a title song. For example, in Cat Ballou, there were 5 other songs and pieces of material. But, of course, you only remember the big one, the nominated song or something. But we've mostly written 4, 5, 6, and 7 songs for every picture. So we're really writing song scores. So that's enough to do without doing the background music.
Okay, and then I was misinformed about also when you write, when you score a movie, you are also contracted to do the incidental music. But normally it's 2 separate people.
Yes, they'll hire someone else to do it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Who were your favorite people to write for as far as singers who really could do your songs justice?
For pop songs?
Anything.
Anything?
Yes.
Well, of course, it was great working for Martin and Lewis because it was a lot of fun. And working for Walt Disney was inspirational. It was a joy. And we learned so much from this. I guess I hate to use the word genius because it's reserved for Beethoven and Bach, but he was a genius of what he was doing. And as far as performers?
Yes.
It was wonderful writing for, so many. I can't think of them.
I don't mean to say just one. Why don't you put a group of 3 or 4 performers together who you feel have really done justice to the song almost exactly the way you wrote it and intended it to be sung?
Yes. For example, when I was in New York in my early years, bands were king, as you know.
Yes.
And Glenn Gray and the Castle Emma Orchestra introduced It's the Talk of the Town and then followed up with Under a Blanket of Blue, it was so gratifying and thrilling because they did it just as we dreamt that we hoped that somebody would do it. Perfection.
Right.
And they became great standards thanks to that great band. And then others carried it on, and they're still being recorded someplace right now. And Al Trace did Mercy Dose just the way we wanted it, and he also introduced it because nobody else wanted to do it. And of course, what can I say about beautiful singer and dear friend Johnny Mathis and his version of The 12th of Never? That was perfection. And of course, Perry Como doing A Dreamer's Wish, Your Heart Makes, and other songs I've written has been just beautiful, and on and on.
I will tell you what, I have to take a break now. Naturally, I help pay for the station. But we will, when we come back from the break, we'll come into Cat Ballou. I don't know the last time you heard that, but might bring back a bright memory. And for anybody else who... I know Channel 38 is the station in this area that shows it at least once a year, but it's been about 5 or 6 months since it's been on, so we'll get a chance to hear Nat King Cole and Stubby K doing The Ballad of Cat Ballou right after this break. It's Touch 1060 you're listening to, and the time here at Touch 1060 is exactly 2:30.
Single? Alone? alone and bored on Sunday nights? There's no excuse for that anymore. We can talk about it on the Single People's Forum, Singles Lifeline, Sundays from 7 to 10 on Touch 1060 Radio. Join me, Mark Snyder, for lively talk and timely information exclusively on the station that touches all of Boston, Touch 1060 Radio. It's Boston's latest dating show in the year, and I hope you'll join us.
It finally happened. Two has become five. Where? At the Brockton East Cinemas, located at the East Shopping Plaza in Brockton. That's right, the Brockton East Cinemas has grown to five theaters right before your eyes. Now there's plenty of variety and plenty of free parking. That's the Brockton East Cinemas, located next to Christo's Restaurant in the East Shopping Plaza in Brockton. For shows, showtimes, and further information for the Brockton East Cinemas, consult your newspaper or call 588-1891. That's 588-1891.
Princess, lend an ear, for you're now about to hear the ballad of Cat Ballou. It's a song that's newly made, and Professor Sam the Shade and the Sunrise Kid are singing it for you. Cat Ballou, Cat Ballou. It's a hanging day in Wolf City, Wyoming. Wolf City, Wyoming, 1894. They're gonna drop Cat Ballou through the gallows floor. She killed a man in Wolf City, Wyoming. Wolf City, Wyoming, killed a man, it's true. And that is why they're hanging, hanging Cat Ballou. The smile of an angel,
bites like the devil.
The eyes of an angel,
bites like the devil.
The face of an angel,
I say she's the devil. She's mean and evil through and through.
Cat Ballou, Cat Ballou, she's mean and evil through and through. With her outlaw band, they're now telling a story, now telling a story, how she rode the plane. The wildest gal in the west since Calamity Jane.
And today's the day that she's going to glory, she's going to glory for the way she sinned.
There'll be a speed in her soul on the wayward wind. She has the smile of an angel,
bites like the devil.
The eyes of an angel,
bites like the devil.
The face of an angel,
I say she's the devil.
She's mean and evil through and through.
Cat Ballou,
Cat Ballou,
she's mean and evil through and through.
Cat Ballou,
Cat Ballou,
she's mean and evil through and through.
Ah, yes, that was Stubby Kaye and Nat King Cole singing Jerry Livingston's Cat Ballou. And Jerry Livingston is on with me right now. Jerry.
Morgan?
Yes.
You just brought tears to my eyes because beautiful Nat Cole was one of my favorite of all singers and everything else. And when we found out that he was signed for the picture, we worked our hearts out, Mac and I, to write, come up with something that we thought he would enjoy. And he got such a kick out of it because he had never done a Western-type song before. And the other voice you hear there is Stubby Kaye.
Yes.
As you know. And it was a joy. And I had a, while you were, I was listening to you playing it, I was back in the at the studio at Columbia Pictures in Hollywood, and Frank Duvall did the background score, and we were taking like 15 takes, you know how you do,
right?
So they got the ones they wanted, and all those memories came flashing back while you played it.
Well, it's funny you mentioned Frank Duvall. I had a chance to speak with him, doing the same sort of interview about a year or so ago.
He's a great guy.
Very nice guy. And he's had an advantage that I guess you haven't, where he has done some in front of the camera work, and people can at least have a chance. The Happy Kind character he played on America Overnight, on Dickensy's Fenster, and other TV shows and movies that he's done.
Yeah.
But have you ever been in any movie or TV show or walk-on, something where people can say, if it ever comes on again, that's the guy Morgan was talking to?
You mean that in a movie personally?
Yes.
No, I never have been.
You've never been in front of the camera?
I had a band in my early years in New York for about a year. I was playing like the Waldorf and in Milwaukee at big hotels and the Peabody and Memphis. And in New York, I made about two or three, they had a series of orchestra shorts, you know?
Yes.
At Warner Brothers in Brooklyn. And so I saw myself on the screen. I said, I better get back to the Brill Building and break up the band and go back to writing songs, and I did.
What technical changes?
What?
Are there any major technical changes that have come into the business of scoring since you began, I'm sure, with computers and
writing for film?
Yes.
And TV?
Yes.
Well, the changes, of course, is the sound now is so fantastic, you know, the computer age.
Yes.
Just like Vangelis last year won the Oscar for that beautiful score he wrote.
Chariots of Fire.
Great theme. But he did it in a studio in London with about six or seven fellas, and he pushed the buttons. So that's one part of it. But it's music in a certain fashion. But the sound today is so beautiful, it inspires you to come up with even more than you want to sometimes or feel it.
But does that aspect of pushing buttons kind of remove you from being in the music?
Well, I don't personally write that way. I'm old-fashioned. I like to sit at the piano and knock out a melody.
Exactly.
And Mac David or Paul Webster or whoever I'll be working a picture with, we sit there side by side sometimes, and there's a warm personal joy in doing that. And I think most of the fellows out here do it that way.
Well, are you still working? What's the most recent thing that you've been involved with, or have you retired?
No, I haven't retired, but I've been thinking about doing another Broadway show. I had a show in Boston that opened in Boston and went to New York in 1973. It was called Molly, and it opened in Boston with Kay Ballard.
I remember that.
I wrote all the score, the music, and Mac David wrote the lyrics, and a fellow named Lenny Adelson. And we played in Boston 3 weeks at the Schubert, and then played in New York for about 6 months, about 75 or 80 performances or 100, but a couple of the critics, whose names I won't mention, didn't care for it too much.
Go ahead. They're in New York and we're in Boston. If they're listening, that's tough. Go mention them if you want.
But I can tell you that it was a big success in Boston.
Yeah.
And we played there 3 weeks. So I said to the producers, why don't we just stay here? The hell with it.
Yeah, why go to New York? I mean, we've got a good audience here. Why leave?
Yeah, well, in 73, the big deal was to play Philadelphia or Boston or someplace.
Yeah.
And then go to Broadway and the Great White Way and all that jazz. But, you know, it's all changing, too. Many a show doesn't go to Broadway. They tour all over America, and they do very well. They play out here for months in San Francisco, and we have a whole series down here at the Chandler Pavilion, and the Niederlanders are out here with about two or three theaters. You don't have to play on Broadway anymore to have a big hit show.
Well, now with the advent of communications, every time you turn on a TV, they're advertising for a major Broadway-type play, but all you have to do is stay in your own community.
Yeah, but Broadway's changed, too. There's no middle-of-the-road musical anymore.
Yeah.
It's either $4 or $5 million like Cats or Nine or something, or Dreamgirls, and it's the scores are not that scintillating, I don't feel, or maybe I'm spoiled by the great words of music of the, you know, the giants like Rodgers and Hammerstein and so forth, and Irving Berlin, but you don't walk out humming the melody, the songs anymore, you walk out humming the scenery, the old bits, you know?
Yeah.
But they're great shows for visual. And maybe we are in a visual age, because that's what they're giving you, is huge productions costing millions, and if it doesn't make it, it goes down the drain.
If you got enough backers that don't have to worry about it, they can write it off as a tax loss.
I guess that's what they do.
Now, the feel for...
I didn't answer your question. I'm thinking right now of possibly writing another Broadway show. I'm just musing about it, you know, thinking about it.
Will there be any, do you have at least an inkling of what you'll be doing for the plot or the type of music, or you just want to do it, you just haven't put it on paper yet?
We're just thinking about it.
Yeah.
We're in the think stage, Morgan. I didn't say speak, I said think.
Well, you were touching on something that I get a lot of comments about, and that's the age bracket difference in media. I won't say television or movies, I'll just group it all together and say media.
Yeah.
The established way of doing something that you have a feel for, that you're touching, that it's part of you, compared with the new way, like you're talking about with Broadway. Everything is sets and lavish and spend money. But the old style of having a couple of guys sit down and tinker on a piano just seems to have been pushed aside. And it seems a shame that that's being lost, or really, is it being lost?
I don't think it's been lost, because in the last few years, we've had some great shows by, well, Chorus Line, Marvin Hamlisch.
Yes.
One of my favorite all-time writers of theater, Stephen Sondheim, he sits down and writes those Sending the Clowns and those great shows and those great song scores, and Cy Coleman and Kander and Ed, what can you say about them? So I don't think that's lost at all.
Do you see any young writers coming up? Well, Marvin Hamlisch would be one that you mentioned, but are there people that will still be able to write that way, following in the footsteps of the names that you've mentioned?
Oh, I think so, definitely. I think we have some great writers today who can write. If they wanted to, they could write for theater, they could write for film, and some of them do. I think Billy Joel is a wonderful writer, and I think the Bergmans, they write words, Alan Bergman and his wife Marilyn. Randy Newman is a very fine writer. He could write theater. Neil Diamond is a wonderful songwriter, besides being a great artist.
Yes.
And I'm crazy about Lionel Richie. And these fellows can, I think they could do any area, just like I have done others, if they choose to. So I think we have them. Right. I really do, Morgan.
Well, it's a matter of, it's like an age-old riddle. Will we still be able to have the same type of geniuses? I know that you mentioned that you don't like to use the word genius freely, but the same type of musical expertise 20, 30, 40 years from now. And to have that, you have to have younger people coming up to replace the older people who were there in front of them. And
well, like in 20 years, the names I just mentioned, they'll be old people.
Yeah, that's true, and hopefully it'll still be able to grow with a new crop of people coming up every 20 years.
Yeah. Well, I'm always aware of what's going on in Billboard and Variety and the records and so forth. And I see, when I hear something I like, I look it up and find that it could be some new writer or a group, or maybe a new Paul McCartney-Lennon team. And they keep coming at you, you know. I knew who Lionel Richie was. I knew he was with the Commodores. But then he left them and stepped on his own, and he's a great songwriter artist.
Yes, he is. He's finally come into his own as far as the four or five things of the past 2 years that he's been doing, Truly and Lady
right.
Kenny Rogers and whatnot.
Right.
Tell you what, I'm going to take my final break of the hour, and I also have a few more themes from your past that you have written that I want to get in. And if anybody would like to call after the hour's up, the numbers again are 969-1060 and 651-1060. But I'm not going to be taking any calls during the interview, so I just want to explain that to the audience. This is for your ears. I want you to sit back, relax, and listen.
Peace.
been years since anybody has heard that theme in its entirety, and that was Casper the Friendly Ghost. I know the station here in Boston that runs at Channel 56, they normally don't include that theme in the cartoon, I guess, to add an extra time, but I do want to thank them now because they went into the studios and they got the theme for me off one of the originals, so I appreciate them for helping me. Once I told them what I wanted it for, Jerry, they immediately said, well, we'd be happy to help you out, because they don't play it normally, and I had to go to the studio that plays Casper. Jerry?
Yeah.
Yeah, I was just explaining that to you, that to get the last theme, I had to go to the TV station in Boston that runs it, and I told them what I wanted it for, that I was interviewing the gentleman who wrote it, and they said,
yeah,
well, if that's the case, of course we'll give it to you.
I was wondering how you got it.
When was
because
the last time you heard
I
that one?
I don't have any record of it.
Well, you don't have that one?
No.
Well, you do now.
Oh, that's great.
We'll be happy to send that one off to you. Well, it'll be in the tape that we send you, a cassette.
I got a kick out of the Room for One More.
Yeah, we've got some pretty good sources to get themes.
Have you got Mary Dotes or the 12th of Never?
You know what? My producer, Neil, did try to get those, and the copy that he had of the 12th of Never was just not good enough for air quality.
Sure.
But we do have some, and we'll try to get you one incorporated in the statement.
Oh,
if you'd like.
All right. Conversation. No
yeah.
problem.
All right. Well, the changes that you were mentioning, the technical changes.
Yes.
I don't know if you feel this way. How do other people that have been working in the business as long as you have feel about the newer changes? Let's say, I know that you mentioned Frank Duvall and Nelson Riddle, Henry Mancini.
I see the fellows out here, and I think that a lot of the fellows are doing their scoring of pictures the way they've been doing them. You listen to the sensational scores that John Richardson has been putting out, you know, for those great pictures like E.T. and the space picture, and he hasn't changed. He does picture after picture with a London Symphony and with that sweeping music of his, and it sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Elmer Bernstein hasn't changed. They're still going along the way they have been, with great success, and they've got their scores piled up. And they're not going into, yes, if a picture calls for a rock and roll beat or something, you can do that. You know, that's no problem.
Yeah. Of the movies and television shows that are on now, I don't know how often you get a chance to watch them, but is there any one TV theme that strikes you is probably head and shoulders above the rest, or one movie theme that's current, let's say within the past couple of years, that strikes you as being so unique and so strong that it's towering over all the others?
Yeah, well, I liked very much that the theme that they wrote with that tinkly piano opening up the Carol O'Connor.
Yes.
I thought that was delightful.
The All in the Family theme?
Yeah. I thought that was fun.
Yeah.
It's kind of a thing that I might have done, you know. But the last year or two, I haven't paid too much attention. I haven't watched too much sit comedy because, I just haven't been.
Yeah. Any particular movie score that strikes your memory over the past two or three years that you've heard that stands out above the rest?
Yes, because I'm a member of the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. In fact, we'll be voting soon for the best pictures and songs and everything else. And I'm on the executive committee of the music branch, so I'm well into that. Scores from pictures I've liked the last few years.
Yes.
I've liked practically everything that Johnny Winters has been doing.
Yeah, that's a good thing to say, especially since you're here in
Boston. Right, that's right. And we're good friends. And he is such a tremendously talented man. I love watching his shows on out here. It's Channel 28 on a PBS station.
Yes.
And with that sensational symphony orchestra you've got there, the Boston Pops.
Yes.
And it's joyous. And I think he's perfect for that whole thing. And I like the music of, I thought that Randy Newman did a wonderful job with Ragtime.
Definitely.
You know, I thought that was a delightful score, wonderful score. He should have won. Maybe he did. I don't remember. But and Marvin Hamlisch did a great job In fact, he brought back Joplin with that wonderful, you know, the
Sting
ragtime music.
Yes.
Yeah. There have been some wonderful scores.
All right. Well, you mentioned that you're on the board that will be voting for the best.
Well, I'm a member of the Academy.
Right.
And we've nominated, as you know, all the pictures and songs and so forth. But the ballots will be going out in a couple of weeks because the show is April 11th on a Monday night, and I think it's on your network.
Yeah. How does that work as far as the balloting for all the categories? I know you.
Oh, it's very simple. In the initial nominating, each branch does its own nominating, like the film editors, the music branch, the actors. They each do their own nominating of five. But then the ballot goes out to all the members, because then each category of five goes to every member of the Academy, wherever they are, and we then vote for those categories, the entire membership. But in the beginning, the nominations are done by each branch.
Okay.
Clear?
Very clear.
Right.
And
we'll know in a couple of weeks.
And well, we'll all cross our fingers that our favorite movie, our favorite song, our favorite actor or actress will get their little gold statuette on the 11th.
Well, sometimes they do and sometimes they don't. Oh, you know, a wonderful score this year I thought was the score of Gandhi.
Kingsley movie.
It was a beautiful
yes.
score. An English composer wrote part of it, and a great Indian from India, he's a great artist.
Yeah.
I can't think of his name. He did the rest with his little group, and I thought it fit the picture. I think a score should work for the film, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes you hear a score, and you can almost hear the director or the producer saying to the writers, or the songwriters, or the background composer, who gets a lyric writer, write me a hit song.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty hard to do, because if you could pick a hit song, you wouldn't have to be working. You could just sit in an office and pick hit songs and make about $14 million a week.
And it doesn't work that way. It doesn't work that way.
No. You have to write to your film or write to your screenplay. That's what we've always done. And for television, I've done lots of television, I think you know, besides television theme songs. I remember we did the Shirley Temple storybook series. It was on ABC.
Yeah, the early 60s, wasn't that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was a beautiful theme in there called Dreams Are Made for Children, but we wrote 16 fairy tales. And that was a joy. We were at Columbia Pictures for 2 years. And what can I tell you, the fun of writing things like Rumpelstiltskin and Beauty and the Beast and Rip Van Winkle. So I'm bringing out a point. I've always enjoyed writing for young folks. It's been fun.
And
because the rest of it falls in line, you know.
I was about to say, I know that with the background of the things that you've written for young children, that shows, but you mentioned something earlier, and I had them get this queued up as quickly as they could, and this is both for you and for everybody else listening, the 12th of Never.
You ask how much I need you, must I explain? I need you, oh my darling. You ask how long I'll love you, I'll tell you true, until the 12th of never, I'll still be loving. Oh,
Was there any meaning of the 12th of Never? It's such a beautiful song.
Yes, there's a story that nobody knows.
All right.
We wrote that for a picture called Julie, starring Doris Day. And she recorded for the picture, the background track was made, the score, and then they decided, the producer or the director or somebody, that it didn't quite work, and they took it out of the picture. But we said, oh gosh, there goes a pretty song. And Paul Webster wrote those beautiful words, as you know. But we had a nice thing in our contract that said, if it doesn't go in the picture, we get it back. So we got it back, and then we took it to Frank Music, which was Frank Lesser's firm. Great Frank Lesser had a publishing firm. And they took it to Mitch Miller at Columbia, and he gave it to Johnny Mathis. And while listening to that record, I was thinking of five million records he sold.
It sold 5 million?
Yeah, well, his single sold about 1.5 million, and then the album was in the charts for 8 consecutive years, and it sold in there.
I do know. He holds some musical record for being the longest-running album.
Yes, it was in that album.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was on the charts for 8 years, consecutively.
That's almost impossible to conceive.
But, Mathis, he does a beautiful job. But the song was written for a picture. I thought you'd get a kick out of that.
And who was to sing it in the movie? Was Doris Day?
Doris Day.
She was to sing that in the movie.
It was a picture called Julie.
And was there anything significant about the 12th of Never from the movie? It's just such a catchy title.
Well, no, it was just that she was in her study, and some guy was trying to get her, and she was in her place looking at the ocean. And she was at the piano, and she wanted to sing something that would soothe her a little bit. And this was the song. But anyway, they took the scene out, and they the cutting room floor a bit, and the song went out. But we got it back, and the rest, you know.
Well, I'm glad you did.
That happened lots of times. I've been on the back of records, like Wake the Town and Tell the People, which is a big standard for me, was on the back of a record that Les Baxter made. And they turned it over, and it was Wake the Town, and it became a big hit. The turnovers, you know.
the flip sides.
What's on the other side?
Flip sides of records.
Yeah.
Well, I've got about 1 minute, so I want to give you a proper goodbye. I want to thank you very much. I've enjoyed this. I hope the audience has.
Well, I've enjoyed it immensely, Morgan.
And
I enjoy with you because I've personally loved the questions you've asked me, and it's been just a lot of fun and wonderful to talk to you.
Well, thank you. And if and when you do come to Boston again to visit your family, you have our number. Write to us and let us know, and I'd love to meet you in person.
Right, I will do, and it'll be fun meeting you face to face.
Thank you very much, Jerry. Take
right.
care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Jerry Livingston, and next up is ABC News on Touch 1060. After that, we've got 2 hours of talking trivia to go, so don't dare go away. Phone numbers are 969-1060 and 651-1060. Once again, this is Touch 1060 AM. My name is Morgan White Jr., the show Talking Trivia, Seattle, ABC News.